and welcome to this Thursday afternoon edition of the Content Sutra podcast. We're here at our Soho headquarters in New York City, and in a few hours, Shane and I are going to test the limits of hipsterdom and go do some deep house yoga and dance party in a Brooklyn warehouse. But first, we have a podcast to do and a very special guest. Shane, I normally intro the guest, but I'm going to throw this one to you.
So I'm happy to introduce our guest who's today in Boston, Maria Konnikova, who's a science and psychology writer for The New Yorker. She's the author of a New York Times bestseller, Mastermind, which is about how to think like Sherlock Holmes, who, as one of my heroes, Sherlock Holmes, that was a particularly interesting book to me until I read her second book, which just came out this week or last week. Is that right, Maria?
Yeah, it came out January 12th. I've lost track of time, so whenever that is.
So Maria's on a whirlwind promotional tour for this book, which is sure to be a hit. It's called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. And the backstory for me that's interesting about this book and what we want to talk about on the podcast is that Maria and I met at a TEDx event where she shared her personal story about growing up in the Soviet Union and immigrating to the US. And I gave a talk about storytelling and sort of the power for good and for evil of storytelling. And so I think we want to talk a bit about, in your book, in The Confidence Game, you deal with the sort of the downside of the power of stories. And so I want to get into that. But I think first, just as some background, would you share briefly your story of your history as a Soviet citizen coming to the U.S. and becoming this groundbreaking journalist, just in brief?
Sure. So I was born in Moscow, and we came to the U.S. when I was 4 years old. I didn't speak a word of English, so I learned the hard way that they speak a different language here, and went to kindergarten, was speaking by the end of the year, and now have the nerve to actually write in English. So that's me conning the world, right?
Very nice. Well, and I think your grasp of the English language is better than most of us, certainly the three of us sitting in this room as native speakers. So talk a little bit about The Confidence Game, and then let's get into the power of story. And you use stories to make your point in this book and in all of your writing, but you also talk about the sort of the dark side of storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I was actually I wasn't shocked, but I was scared to find out and to discover, really, as I was delving into the world of con artists and figuring out what makes them so good. And when I realized that they are just consummate storytellers, they can weave the most perfect narratives that really create the world that we want to live in, that we want to believe in, that draws us in emotionally, so that we, you know, our logic, our reasoning just turns off. We are part of this. We're part of this story, so we stop questioning it. And what just I realized as I was finding this out is I do the exact same thing as a journalist, as a writer. You know, that's what we do. We also craft narratives to drive, you know, to drive change, to affect how people think, to draw them in and make them experience things that they otherwise wouldn't experience. And the affinity between the two is actually quite scary. You realize that the exact same tools can be used for good or for evil, and then you start taking a step back and your head starts hurting very quickly, because then you start getting into these meta philosophical questions. Well, who determines what's good and what's evil, and why is what I'm doing any better than what a con artist does? And then you just decide to stop and turn off your computer and be done for the day.
Well, so the irony is really apparent, but it makes me a little bit conflicted as a storyteller. And at Contently, you know, the company that we work for, our motto is tell great stories. And, you know, we always say that great stories build relationships and make people care. But it's so striking how it can be used on both sides, for good and for ill. And one of the things that struck me about your book is it's not clear that the smarter you are, the better you are at not falling for cons. Talk a little about that.
Well, it's not just not clear. I think we have a clear answer, which is that intelligence doesn't protect you. There have been a few studies that have tried to look at the profiles of people who've fallen for con artists to try to see, you know, is there anything about their background, demographics, who they are, that makes them vulnerable. And what the researchers in this particular study found was that different types of cons have different types of victims. So for instance, being very intelligent can protect you against lottery fraud, but it makes you more susceptible to investment fraud. So there is nothing that's universally protective. It really depends on the situation. And what I came out of that realizing is that there's a con for everyone, and there's nothing that you can do. There's a con for skeptics. There's a con for con artists. There are actually cons designed to con artists, and they work. And that, to me, is the best demonstration that absolutely anyone can be a victim. Because if you do this for a living and you're actually good at it, and you can still be a mark, that tells you just how powerful some of these techniques are.
Let's go into that. How do you con a con artist? Because that sounds like if I figure that out, I would have the best BuzzFeed headline ever for a story I wrote about it. So tell me, give me all of your secrets.
So I think that con artists actually make very good marks because they don't think they can ever be conned. And so they really are prone to overconfidence, which makes them a little bit blind. So let me tell you a story about one of my favorite con artists from the book who ended up being a mark as well. So he, his name was Oscar Hartzell, and he decided that he was going to sell a fortune, and this was the Sir Francis Drake fortune. He told this very compelling story, very emotional, about how Sir Francis Drake died and wasn't able to leave this vast treasure to anyone because his only living heir was illegitimate because it was the son of Queen Elizabeth. So, you know, drum roll, very, very dramatic. And so for centuries, all of this treasure was basically swept up in bureaucracy because nobody wanted anyone to have it. And so he tells the story and he says, but now, you know, we're really, really close to being able to free the money up. And anyone who invests to try to help us clear the red tape, you'll see, you know, your thousandfold returns because there's just so much money. Think about how much a treasure from the 1500s is worth today. And so hundreds of people over several decades gave him millions of dollars. And this guy goes to London because he wanted to live in London is the real reason, but he told them that he needed to be closer to the bureaucratic entanglement so that he could be on the ground and monitor everything there. Sees a newspaper advertisement for a seance session and ends up falling for a psychic. So he is someone who's very skeptical. He knows that people are con artists, and he knows that psychics don't exist. And yet this woman is so good that she manages to convince him that she is the real thing. And the way that she then gets to know him is she hires a private investigator to follow him. So she figures out that he's what he's into. And so then she's able to use that information to really make him believe that she sees what nobody else sees. And over a number of years, he ends up losing tens of thousands of dollars to her. And one would think that a psychic is just the last thing that a seasoned, successful con artist would fall for. And yet the right type of psychic can fool even that person.
I actually, when I was reading your book, I thought about going around New York City and split testing psychics. So going to, you know, five in one day, wearing the same outfit, telling, you know, the same story and seeing what different stories they gave me. But by the time I got done with the book, I was a little bit scared that, you know, maybe one of the five would actually, and I'm, you know, I think psychics are total BS. But it made me nervous that, you know, you don't know what's going to trip you up or surprise you.
Wait, so is that why Absolutely. That person with a crystal ball now has a board seat?
Yeah, I mean, well, no, she's it's not a crystal ball. It's a magic talisman. Okay. Yeah. So you talk about in the book, you talk about Super Bowl ads and how advertising that has strong narrative components tends to do very well. So I guess the question is, do you think that advertisers are con artists?
It's a very good question, and one I actually gave a lot of thought to, because when you think about it, I mean, a lot of the techniques they use, a lot of the approaches they use are the exact same as those that a con artist uses. And for myself, and I think that it's a, you know, it's shades of gray, and the dividing line can fall in different places depending on whom you ask. But for me, it's a question of intent. Do you have nefarious intentions? Are you willfully deceiving people, knowing exactly what you're doing and doing it anyway because you get some sort of personal satisfaction out of it, whether that satisfaction is financial, emotional, whatever it is you're getting out of it, but you know exactly what you're doing? Or, you know, do you actually kind of believe what you're doing? And sure, you know, you realize that this face cream isn't going to make you look 10 years younger, but you really do think that it has benefits. And so you're selling this to people, and yes, you're selling them a product, but you actually think that it's something that can make them happier, and that offers good value. I think in that case, you're not a con artist. You're just someone using similar tactics. But as I say, it's shades of gray. I mean, you have advertisers who absolutely are con artists. There's overlap. The first snake oil salesman, he was an advertiser. You know, he created ads. You have those infomercials where people often know that they're just basically peddling snake oil, and yet they do it anyway because they get financial incentives out of it. A lot of Dr. Oz's guests, I would say, are snake oil peddlers, and they know it. And those are con artists. But the majority of people who work in advertising, who work in companies for brands on campaigns that are kind of legitimate and that actually might bring joy or whatnot to people, I would say no. It's kind of, those are more soft con rather than actual con skills.
So this actually reminds me of this study I got sent this morning by, it was done by these professors at the University of Notre Dame, and they showed that with performance apparel, so like Under Armour, Nike, stuff like that, you tell people you have a strong performance apparel brand, you have that sense that like you put this on and you are amazing, you can run a million miles an hour, you're stronger, you're better, and it actually works and ups performance, they find. So you get there, you get in the morning, you put on your Under Armour gear, you look yourself in the mirror and you're like, hell yeah, like I'm going to crush this workout. Then you go out and people actually do better than if they were like wearing their raggedy old sweats and are kind of like feel schleppy. And that's like that one, that those weird middle grounds in advertising. Say you create content or brand messaging that enforces this really positive effect that your gear is going to have, your product is going to have, that actually can psychologically make people perform better and actually get the results, even if, you know, Under Armour isn't, you know, infusing your body with, you know, extra fast twitch muscles that make you go faster.
Absolutely. Well, and there are a few very sound principles behind that. First, I mean, you're not just putting it on, you're also seeing yourself differently. And we know that self-perception actually matters and self-affirmation matters. So psyching yourself up often does work precisely the way it should, because you see yourself in a more positive light, and that actually makes you perform better. In fact, there's one study that I looked at in the confidence game about swimmers, competitive swimmers, and it looked at self-deception. So how do you see yourself versus reality? And the people who were higher on self-deception, so the swimmers who actually had a much more optimistic bias, ended up doing better competitively. They were better swimmers. And there was a very objective measure in the study. They did these tests, and then they saw who had qualified for the national championship, and they found that the higher your self-deception, the more likely you were to qualify. And so I think that gets at that we actually have a very strong self-deception tendency, and it works, which is the other thing I was going to say. Effect is the best thing in the world. If you think it works for you and it ends up working, then that's wonderful, even if the product itself does absolutely nothing.
Was you cut out for a brief second, was it the placebo effect that you said absolutely works?
Yes, the placebo effect, yeah. Absolutely works.
You know, there's an interesting, I talked to a scientist, I want to say at Northwestern, not long ago, mm-hmm. who was doing work on depression, and about, basically he was looking into why placebos tend to have some effect that's comparable in many cases to SSRI, depression medication, mm-hmm. and it was for that very reason that if you believe something's going to work, then your brain actually will form neural pathways to sort of show you the way for something to work, and that that has some effect with depression. So there's an actual physiological effect to the placebo effect, at least in some cases, at some level.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I think that we really, when people say placebo effect, they often see it as a bad word, you know, or I guess a bad two words. They say, oh, it means it's all in my head. It's not real. You know, that's BS. It's really terrible. But I think that we need to realize that it's all in your head is actually a lot of things, and that doesn't make it any less powerful or any less effective. And there's even, you know, there are people who've devoted their careers to trying to figure out how do we make the placebo effect even stronger. There's a guy at Harvard, Ted Kapchuk, who actually does basically clinical drug trials and all sorts of things to try to figure out, you know, how do we maximize, how do we harness the placebo power? Because it's an incredibly powerful thing. And con artists use, because they use that self-deception. They use our beliefs to make us think things are true that aren't actually true. Once again, the same thing being used for good or for evil.
And does that end up being dangerous? You're a con artist and you convince yourself, you're like, well, I'm lying to these people, but they're feeling better about themselves. You know, that psychic, it's like, well, I'm taking $10,000, but he's really into it and he feels like his life is getting better. You kind of morally justify your actions by saying, well, the placebo effect works. And in fact, though I'm promising something and not delivering it, I am doing good in some way.
Yeah, that is very, very dangerous. And a lot of con artists do exactly that, because almost all of them will tell you that they're good people, and that they aren't, you know, they're not evil, they're not actually really harming anyone. They have these phenomenal justifications for what they do. And in fact, there was one psychic that I wrote about in the book, who's in jail right now, but when she went, during her trial, she went on the stand and she actually said, you know, well, I think that these people would have been worse off without me. I made them better because I gave them a lot of positive things. And by the way, I think their life would have been, you know, everything would have gone even more horribly wrong. Who's to say that I didn't actually help ward off some evil? And this is after women have paid her tens of thousands of dollars that they couldn't afford. And, you know, there's a lot of proof, as I say, she's in jail right now, that she did really some nasty stuff. And yet she was standing there and saying this with a completely straight face.
Yeah, that sounds like exactly the same justification that Dr. Phil uses.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, you see that a lot in medicine, right? Or in sort of positive mm-hmm. psychology.
Well, I mean, Dr. Phil's like out there peddling a different like cranberry supplement that's gonna like yeah. make you like change your life every single
Don't
day.
Don't get me started on antioxidants.
So one thing we were talking about before the podcast is wondering, what role does social media play in all this? Because it just makes con artists, you know, it gives con artists such a great platform for reaching people and for executing cons. I mean, catfishing is one of the biggest thing now. I think there are like three different reality shows about
it. Or fake stories, you know, there's stuff that yeah. blows up on Facebook or on Twitter that then later turns out to be fake. It seems like this, you see one of these every week now.
More than every week, every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just a few days ago, I don't know if you guys saw the fake Politico journalist who was making friend requests to other journalists and writers on Facebook, and people were actually accepting them, even though this woman, I'm going to call her woman because she was a woman on her social media profile, punchline, there's no such person at Politico, so it was a catfishing thing. But everyone was accepting her friend request. And because she seemed already vetted by other people, because you know her, she's in someone else's network, political, you know what that is, seems safe, seems familiar, you just accept it. And before long, she actually has a network of friends. She's infiltrated this group. So I actually went to my friend request inbox. I never accept requests from people I don't know. And that's, by the way, a very good tip for trying to avoid at least one kind of scam. If you don't know the person or know exactly who they are, say no. But I went to my inbox to see if I had a friend request from her, because I was like, hey, why didn't she friend request me? She did. So there she was. And do you want to know how many friends we had in common? 80. 80. So that means that 80 of my journalist friends, people who are supposed to be skeptical and kind of, you know, who do this kind of stuff for a living, had accepted her as a friend before this whole thing unraveled.
Wow. So one of the things that, when we met at the Columbia event, I gave a talk about storytelling, and I kind of ended on this, we need to, as people who have this now, this power to amplify stories across the internet and sort of in a way that we never had before, we have a responsibility to not deceive, and that human beings, in addition to being sort of imbued with this power to dream and make believe and invent stories and craft tales, also have this power to discern. And that in the long run, sort of the thing that I was trying to say was that in the long run, really deceptive storytelling gets outed. However, I wonder anymore how, I guess, two questions. One, how true is that? And two, what can we do as, you know, everyday people to prevent from being deceived by stories? How do you discern whether a story is true or not?
So there's no Pinocchio's nose of lying. There's nothing that will tell you that somebody is lying or telling the truth, because the best liars, it's a part of their fabric of their identity. It's who they are. They don't actually, they're not deceiving in a sense, because they're just being themselves, and it's not at all uncomfortable for them. And so the same exact thing is true of storytelling, that we can't tell if a story is good and true or good and false unless we start verifying. Our initial impulse upon reading anything is to think that it's true. That's a very, very strong impulse. In fact, a lot of work has been done on the fact that when we see the world, our default reading of the world is true. And only then do we verify, do we say, oh, maybe this isn't true, maybe this is actually false. But that second part often doesn't happen. So if we look at a story that was in the media a lot this last year, which was the Rolling Stone rape story, we had a reporter who'd found this girl at the University of Virginia, told this absolutely riveting, shocking, terrible story of rape that prompted all sorts of investigations at the University of Virginia. Frats were shut down. All sorts of stuff happened at other universities as well. And we obviously know right now that the story was false, that it was, that the girl at the center of the story had made a lot of this up, and that the reporter had not done her homework. She was conned, basically. There are multiple layers there. But when a story is really, really good, you know, we often just believe it. And she failed, I think, the basic journalistic dictum, which is trust but verify. She wanted to trust so much that she didn't verify. But most people who read that story did not think that it was false. Most people believed it because it's very believable, because there's nothing that sets this apart from a story that's not believable.
On that note, what makes for a convincing story, whether it's true or not?
I think that the more emotional it is, the more it can get us to empathize and to emotionally relate to the material, the more convincing it is by very virtue of that empathetic connection. Because what ends up happening when we're emotionally involved in a story is that we stop thinking logically and we stop seeing logical inconsistencies. There's a lot of work that's been done on emotional transportation. So how much does a narrative transport you emotionally into its frame? And what ends up happening is the more transported you are, the fewer false notes you spot, the fewer inconsistencies you spot, basically the more convinced you become of the entire story and all of the things that it implies. So people might change their political beliefs at the end of it, and they don't even realize really what's happened. It's just that they were really emotionally involved with the story. So I think that's what the best storytellers do. They really involve you on an emotional level. It can be positive, it can be negative, it can be about anything, it can be structured in any way, but it's a compelling narrative that really draws you in.
So you wrote a piece a while ago for The New Yorker that I remember, it must have been last year, a couple of years ago, about why people are so hard to convince to change their political beliefs or their preconceived notions. Where does storytelling fit in with, I guess, the calcification of our beliefs and the ability to change calcified beliefs?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And the pessimistic takeaway of the piece that you're referring to was that basically if the belief is entrenched enough, it's impossible to change. And the more you try to bring evidence to bear, the less likely you're going to be to change someone's mind.
So Donald Trump ain't going to change parties then.
Exactly.
Well, they actually found that recently with Donald Trump supporters. There was a study where they brought in a bunch of Donald Trump supporters from Iowa and presented them with, you know, counterfacts to their beliefs, and it actually emboldened their beliefs more. It's the difference between being uninformed and misinformed, they found, is that misinformed people actually, when you present them with evidence to the contrary, it just makes them believe what they believe even more.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. That is absolutely in keeping with all of the research that I've seen. So your question though is, where do stories fall here? And I think it depends on which beliefs we're talking about. If these really are calcified beliefs, a story is not going to change them. But in terms of effectiveness, if this is something where you're capable of change and the story is more subtle, it doesn't actually address this head on. But there is, you know, protagonist, for instance. So one of the stories that was used in these emotional transportation studies, it was basically about a girl who was murdered in a mall by someone who you find out has escaped from a mental health facility. And so that really ends up changing people's beliefs on mental health and on what should be done to mental health patients and mental health in America. And because that's not what the story is about, it actually becomes a little bit more effective. And people don't even realize their beliefs have changed. They just really are so emotionally drawn into this story that they're reacting to this specific fact and not to kind of their ideal beliefs or whatnot. And I think in that sense, stories can be more effective than a lot of other type of evidence, because we often take individual stories and base anecdotal evidence like that and base belief systems off of those versus off of kind of broader statistical knowledge. Anecdotes speak much louder than almost anything else.
And you know, one thing that I think you've mentioned in your book too, you cite this research that in terms of the persuasive power, this is really true with Super Bowl ads in particular, that if you have that kind of dramatic, really good story that is infused with emotion and dramatic plot line, that's what convinces people that something is true or that a brand is good or has these traits that they're trying to get across.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's a guy who used to work in advertising who then started working with Super Bowl ads as a psychologist. And because of what he knew about stories, he said, I can predict which ads are going to do the best, and those are going to be the ads with the most compelling storyline. So he studies Super Bowl ads and figures out that the only thing that matters is, does it have a compelling story? And so a few years ago, he watches all of the ads prior to the Super Bowl, and he predicts which one is going to do best, and it's Budweiser. I think everyone remembers, I don't like football, I don't watch the Super Bowl, even I know this ad. It's about a little puppy and a horse, and they have this wonderful friendship, and it's such a short ad, But you, I mean, what an adorable puppy who loves this horse, and then they're separated, which is heartbreaking and terrible. And then at the end, there's this big reunion, and you see the horse and the dog running next to each other. And it's just so beautiful because these lifelong friends are going to be reunited, and everyone is so happy. And, you know, you cry because it's just a beautiful story. And he said that ad is going to outperform every other ad. The ad with the naked chicks, the ad with, you know, the cool guys, everything else, it's going to be that. And he was right. That ad was by far the most successful because it was basically a feature film condensed into a short Super Bowl spot. It told a really compelling story, and that's what people want. And I don't even remember how Budweiser figured into this. I mean, there's nothing about beer in a relationship. I think the owner of the farm or something drank Budweiser, but I don't remember. And that's the point. But I know it was a Budweiser ad. Do you remember how Budweiser figured into this?
So, like, the iconic Budweiser image is the Clydesdales, the horses that, like, are carrying the beer on the carriage, and it's like, it's Christmas and it's America and it's Budweiser, and it makes you feel all the feelings. But yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting story. Although, like, the counter argument would be is, like, he just picked the ad that had puppies in it, and that was kind of easy.
But there were other ads with puppies and with babies, and there were other ads with very cute things, but that's the ad that did the best. So, and he makes this point. He says it's not babies, it's not puppies, it's the storyline. Now, babies and puppies do better than other things, but storylines do best of all.
Yeah, so it's like the same story about babies and puppies will do better than story about an accountant. But if the story about the accountant is really good, it will be the non-story baby and puppy ad.
Well, there's something to that because it has to be a good story. It has to be an emotionally compelling story. And I don't know if you can tell an emotionally compelling story about an accountant in 30 seconds.
You know, this, what you're saying about stories being more powerful than data, I was just looking through my search history because I you know how you settle arguments by searching on Google on the spot, and that's how you become a really annoying person. Well, I did this the other day to a friend of mine who we were arguing about generic drugs. And she said, generic drugs are not the same as brand name drugs. And I said, yes, they are. And she said, no, they're not, because my grandma got really sick when she started taking generics over brand name drugs. And so I looked it up, and it turns out that she was wrong. But because it was the story about her own grandmother, that was a much more powerful connection. And even she didn't believe when I showed her the, you know, the Google result. And then I felt even worse because it was her grandma. But I think that's the power that we're talking about, that, like, medical data, like, we will choose to believe the story that is more sort of emotionally connected to us than anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And we're going to refuse to believe something if it's, especially so, for your friend, it was also personal experience. And we know from a lot of data on how people learn that we learn from personal experience much more than we learn from anything else. So, for instance, when it comes to risk assessment, people who've actually survived a natural disaster are going to look very differently at things like flood insurance or hurricane insurance or whatnot than people who never have, because you think about it in a different way if you've actually been through that. If it was worse than you expected, better than you expected, you'll either become more or less cognizant of the actual risks. And this happens, I think, in all walks of life.
So, you know, all this, the big question makes me think about is, how much does the actual truth really matter? Because it seems like for a lot of people, you know, it's the story that is really the predominant factor in what people believe and what the truth is to them. So, you know, by that means, like, how much does actual facts and data and the fact that, you know, generic drugs are the same as brand name drugs really matter when, you know, just the predominant stories in our lives will determine a lot of our beliefs?
This is getting at one of the key, I guess, questions about journalism and the role of the journalist, right? And kind of ethics and all of that. I mean, I think that's a huge question, but I think Maria should answer it.
Yeah. Also, what is the meaning of life?
sorry. No, please continue.
No, I was just joking. I said also, what is the meaning of life? Because that was just a gigantic question we flipped through your way.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's start with the meaning of life, and then we can talk about the meaning of truth. Does truth, how much does truth matter? I mean, I think it depends on the person, obviously. And everyone would say that truth matters to them. But the reality is, I think that truth isn't the first value of, I don't know if most people, but certainly a lot of people. I would say most, but that's just my opinion, and that might not actually be true. There are other values that come first. And if something trumps truth and is one of your values that comes higher in that hierarchy, you will give up truth for that. So you see this all the time in cons when you're dealing with people who will refuse to see evidence because they want to believe in something bigger. So there's one story of a spiritual leader who ended up being a con artist. And even when this leader was in court and the parishioners were there and there was evidence, you know, there were documents that showed, look, these donations that were supposed to go to charity, he went to Vegas and he gambled them away, and these are gambling debts. And this went here, and this went here, and this is a terrible person. People disregarded it. They said, no, I don't believe you. I still think that this is, you know, this is my leader. This is a wonderful human being. This is a wonderful man. You're making this up. At that moment, I think if you ask any of these people, they say, of course, truth is important. But when you get them in a situation where something else matters more, truth right away recedes and is no longer that important. And I think we see this much more often than we'd like to admit. Even for journalists, I think this is why the Rolling Stone journalist ended up falling for this story of rape. I don't think, you know, obviously I've never spoken with her, and as far as I know, she wasn't out to maliciously con anyone. She really believed in her story, and presumably for her, truth is important. And yet the topic of rape and of getting equal kind of getting treatment for these women, of getting their voices heard, of having equal respect on campuses for women as for men, that was her primary motivation, I think, in writing that piece. And so that's why she didn't push the truth as much as she could have done, because the story was just too good. So I think even in professions like journalism, where truth should absolutely be the first thing we're thinking about, some people in the right situation where they have another agenda are going to push the boundaries and sometimes even just completely ignore the boundaries, often without realizing it and without meaning to, without actually setting out to con anyone.
Yeah, this reminds me of something. I don't know if it was in your book or somewhere else that I read recently about a nonprofit where basically the spokespeople for the nonprofit were being coached to essentially exaggerate their stories in order to sort of appeal to the public. And, you know, the justification was this is doing good. And yet the blowback from that exaggeration or those sort of, you know, fibs being found out was so much worse for the cause. I think that's the downside, right, mm-hmm. to using the powerful tool in a deceptive way for good, is that if it gets found out that you're not being sort of above board, then it's that much worse for you and your cause.
Absolutely. So, this is from my book. It's about Somali Mom, who ran a charity for women who had been victims of sex trafficking. And she did coach women, and she picked the best possible people to appear on camera. Some of them, by the way, had terrible stories, but weren't actually victims of sex trafficking. They were victims of something else. And so I think when you do that, you do end up doing more harm than good, because already people often disbelieve women who come forward and say that they're victims of rape. There's already a lot of skepticism, and now this is fodder for people who say, see, you can't trust them, they all lie. So I think people should really think twice, and that's why, you know, if you tell me should truth be the most important thing, I say, well, in most situations, yes, especially in journalistic situations, especially in situations where people's lives can be negatively affected if you misuse these sorts of storytelling techniques.
You kind of lose the power of your own story, and other people can use it against you if you don't pursue that truth.
They can use that anecdote as a story as to why the data that might prove something is... they use your false story as their story.
Yeah. I mean, that's why we still need fact checkers in American journalism. It's one of the things that's getting depleted in so many newsrooms, and yeah. It's one of the more troubling things going on right now.
Well, that's a question. So when my first book came out a year and a half ago, and Maria was kind enough to write some kind words about it, and which hopefully wasn't a con, but
Shane, I've got something to tell you.
Oh no. on air in front of everyone. But one of the things that was shocking to me is, I went with one of the big publishing houses, and they're great, but I got to the point where I handed in my manuscript, and I emailed my editor, and I said, so when does this go through fact check? And she said, oh no, we don't have a fact check department. And that was so surprising to me. So I guess the question there, and so this is, to Joe's point, that's one of the first things to go when costs are cut. Did your book on cons get fact-checked?
Yeah, it's a good question, and no. So I tried to fact-check it as much as I could myself, obviously. It did go through a legal read by lawyers, because a lot of the people I write about are still alive, and a lot of it is potentially libelous if I get anything wrong. And so it did get greater scrutiny. My first book, nothing happened. No one fact-checked. Certainly no one from legal looked at it. This book, at least I had a legal team.
You had an economic
incentive.
Provided
by the publishers, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're starting to run out of time before we get kicked out of our makeshift studio here. But one question I really wanted to get to, an important one, and that I've been wondering the entire time this podcast, is what role did my boy Leo and the movie Catch Me If You Can play in inspiring this book? Was it like 100% of the inspiration or just 75%?
I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio inspires me every day of my life. I think is the answer to that
That's
question.
The right answer.
But the real answer is that actually I was inspired by a movie. It just wasn't Catch Me If You Can. It was David Mamet's House of Games. I don't know if you guys have seen it. Have either of you seen it?
No, but I know about it.
All right. So. Get thee to a television or to a computer and watch it. I think it's one of his best films, and it's his first film about and it's about con artists, and it's all about one single lawn con, and the protagonist is this woman who is a psychologist, a writer, someone who's really, really smart, and she thinks she's in on the con. That's kind of the kicker. She knows she's dealing with con artists. She thinks that she's learning about them and that she's along for the ride. She doesn't realize that she's the target of the long con. And obviously by the end of the movie, she gets conned and it's all really devastating and terrible. And that movie actually was the inspiration for the book, because it was such a nuanced portrayal of what a victim could be like. And it really upends your expectations of what a victim is and is not.
I think we're going to have to bleep out select parts of that so that we didn't just ruin the movie for our hundreds of thousands of visitors, of readers,
yes,
and listeners.
Spoilers are the worst thing you can do on the internet.
Yeah,
it's true. We're going to have David Mamet fans with pitchforks on our doorstep. All right, so let's wrap it up here. Thank you so much for joining the podcast. Shane, I'm going to kick it to you to return that favor for the nice words that Maria wrote about Smart Cuts and give your best book hype send off to end the podcast.
I don't know that I can give my best book hype send off because this book was so good that it defies words. I think The Confidence Game is the most interesting book I've read in a long time. And if you've seen my desk, we can maybe even post a photo with this podcast. It's piled with about 35 books in a stack right now. So this is definitely one that you want to read. It's not only useful, but it's fascinating.
And Shane, where can I get it?
You can get it probably on Amazon, but Maria has actually a really cute website. It's just mariakonnikova.com, right?
It is, yes.
Spelled with two Ks and two Ns. And she's not Maria Popova, who's another amazing writer. Don't confuse the two. They both do amazing work. But this is Maria Konnikova, author of The Confidence Game.
All right, Maria, thank you again for joining us. And good luck with the book tour and all the hype. Hopefully everyone can match Shane's wonderful send-off and hype game.
Thank you. Thank you both so much. And Shane, thank you for that amazingly generous send-off. It's really lovely of you to say. And it's so nice of both of you guys to have me on. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. And to all our listeners, we'll see you again soon.